This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Charlie Savage, is the legal correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's been reporting on changes in the Justice Department under the Bush administration and writing about the investigation into the firings of 9 U.S. attorneys. The positions are supposed to be nonpartisan appointments. The Bush administration says the attorneys were fired for performance reasons, but Congress is investigating whether the firings were politically motivated so that the attorneys could be replaced by people more in sync with the Bush administration. Savage won a Pulitzer Prize last month for his articles on President Bush's record-setting use of presidential signing statements, which have allowed him to constitutionally challenge new laws and bypass them without having to issue a veto. Savage is now completing a book focusing on the expansion of executive powers under the Bush administration. It will be published in September. Charlie Savage, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on that Pulitzer.
Thank you very much.
You recently wrote a story on the Regent University School of Law. This is a school that was founded by televangelist Pat Robertson. How does Regent connect to the larger story of changes in the Justice Department and the firing and replacing of U.S. attorneys?
Regent University School of Law connects to the U.S. attorney firings and replacement affair in two ways. The first way is through the person of Monica Goodling, the former Justice Department liaison to the White House, who played a central role in helping evaluate which U.S. attorneys ought to be fired and who they ought to be replaced with, and who was in regular communication with the White House, notably the office of Karl Rove, during this process. She later resigned. The second way in which Regent University connects to the scandal is in its unusual success in placing graduates, both of the law school and of the larger university, in government jobs of influence. Under the Bush administration, this university as a whole has placed at least 150 of its graduates into government jobs, according to the university itself. And that's interesting because Regent itself is a very new university. It's a school that is still struggling to build an academic reputation. Its law school is ranked as a Tier 4 school by U.S. News and World Report, which is the lowest possible score. And it's not the kind of place that you would normally suspect that many, many, many graduates would find success at the upper reaches. Part of the U.S. attorney hiring and firing affair has been this larger question of accusations of politicization at the Justice Department. That is to say, of hiring changes over the last 6 or 7 years under the Bush administration, which critics charged have placed ideology and partisan credentials above qualifications and credentials when deciding who should be filling these powerful positions of government responsibility.
Have people raised questions about whether Monica Goodling was qualified for her position in the Justice Department, or whether it seemed that she was hired to promote a certain agenda?
Yes, one of the themes of the controversy over the last few months has been charges and accusations by Democrats and other critics of what has happened in the Justice Department, along the lines that people who are not qualified for the jobs, they say, are being given positions of great responsibility because they have the right ideology under the administration's view, if not the level of experience or the credentials. And so at a recent Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, for example, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, one a former U.S. attorney himself, asked the question, should we be concerned about the experience level of the people who are making these very important decisions about hiring and firing U.S. attorneys? Neither Monica Goodling nor Kyle Sampson, the former chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez, who was also a leader in this effort, had significant prosecutorial experience. And in the case of Monica Goodling as well, she came from a law school which did not give her the usual credential one would have for a high-ranking job in the Justice Department.
You've written about some of the hiring practices that were changed under the Bush administration that relate to the scandal surrounding the firing and replacing of U.S. attorneys. And this goes back to 2002 under Attorney General John Ashcroft, who changed some longstanding rules for hiring lawyers to fill vacancies in the ranks. How did he change the rules in 2002?
Prior to 2002, political appointees had much less control over who would be hired to fill a vacancy in the career ranks of the Justice Department. And in the Civil Rights Division, for example, where voting rights laws are affected or are enforced, committees of veteran career attorneys would screen applicants and conduct interviews and essentially decide who to hire when there was a vacancy. Political appointees had to sign off on their recommendation, but they always accepted it under both Republican and Democratic administrations. After 2002, when Attorney General Ashcroft made this change, the career hiring committees were disbanded, and political appointees did the entire hiring process from start to finish. And this caused some dramatic changes in the profile of who was being hired to enforce laws, especially civil rights laws. And it connects to the U.S. attorney scandal, especially through the voting rights section of the Civil Rights Division. Because in the beginning of 2003, a lawyer named Bradley Schlossman was given the position of being the political appointee who oversaw the voting rights section, along with a few others. And career officials from that section say that he took an unusual interest in hiring decisions and just basically took over control of the whole process, taking advantage of this new policy that Attorney General Ashcroft had put out. And under Mr. Schlossman, the profile of attorneys who are being hired to enforce voting rights laws in order to protect minorities shifted dramatically. Prior experience in civil rights fell. Half of the lawyers that he hired listed the Federalist Society on their resumes or were members of the Republican National Lawyers Association. And according to McClatchy newspapers, he was also telling applicants to leave such markers off of their resumes in order to get hired, so the numbers may be even higher than that. In addition, the quality of the law school from which the hires were coming plunged. In the 2 years before Mr. Schlossman took over and the policy was changed, the average law school ranking, according to U.S. News & World Report, was 15 for new hires to that section. In the 3 years after he took over hiring, it dropped to 65 on average. Then, in March of 2006, Mr. Schlossman was moved out of the voting rights section and installed in Western Missouri as the first new replacement U.S. attorney. And so his record in voting rights law in the 3 years before that change connects to the U.S. attorney's firing scandal, both because he was the first replacement U.S. attorney and because because we know that vote fraud prosecutions were a major part of the motivation behind the replacements. That is to say, the desire on the part of Karl Rove to bring more voter fraud investigations against Democrats in battleground states.
Another part of the story that you've written about is how under Attorney General John Ashcroft, the Justice Department tried to find ways to replace U.S. attorneys without having them go through Senate confirmation. And they managed to change the rules on that. How?
Well, the main aspect of this is that when the USA Patriot Act was reauthorized finally in March of 2006 after a long fight, there had been slipped into it by a Republican staffer in the drafting of the bill at the request of the Justice Department, a then unnoticed provision that gave the Attorney General the power to permanently replace U.S. attorneys without Senate confirmation. And that was a piece of the puzzle. The emails and such have shown that have since been released by the department as far as enabling them then to put people into U.S. attorney positions who would not otherwise be likely to survive vetting by the Senate. Notably in Arkansas, Tim Griffin, who is an aide to Karl Rove and an opposition researcher for the Republican National Committee, who had no support from the local senators, not the type of person who would normally become a U.S. attorney had he had to go through Senate confirmation. And what you referred to under General Attorney General Ashcroft is sort of unknown how this what I'm about to talk to connects to this. But I found an interesting memo from the Office of Legal Counsel a couple years earlier, I think in 2003, in which there was early brainstorming going on about how to replace U.S. attorneys without Senate confirmation, or that is to say, how long they could put a replacement U.S. attorney in without having to worry about Senate confirmation. Because under the rules as they then existed prior to the Patriot Act change, they could only do so for 120 days. But they had figured out a creative way to call someone first an interim and then an acting U.S. attorney and get nearly a year of U.S. attorney service out of them without any Senate vetting. It's unknown, however, to me at least, whether that early brainstorming connects in any way to what followed a couple years later.
Now the thing that was slipped into the reauthorization of the Patriot Act that said that these replacement attorneys would not require Senate confirmation, do you think that most of the senators and congressmen who voted for this bill realized that that was in there?
No senator or member of Congress has stepped forward to say that they knew that was in there. And all of them who have spoken about it have said they did not know it was there. And they both chambers have since, in overwhelming bipartisan votes, voted to repeal that change. The bill has not become law yet because it's still in conference committee. But it's clear that Congress as a whole, without regard to party, is outraged that happened.
The larger question here is, has the Bush administration consciously tried to make the staff of the Justice Department and the U.S. attorneys fit the political agenda of the Bush administration, even in positions that are supposed to be politically nonpartisan? You have been doing research into this question in various areas. One of the areas was the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, in which you found evidence that not only was the staff changing, but the agenda was changing too. Would you just sum up that for us?
Certainly. Last year, I used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain the resumes of successful hires to the Civil Rights Division over the last 6 years in three sections. And what I found was that starting in 2003, after this change in procedures had gone through giving political appointees greater control of who would be hired, the profile of the attorneys being hired changed dramatically. They were much less likely to have prior experience in traditional civil rights enforcement. To the extent they did have that experience, it was just as often people who had been fighting against traditional civil rights enforcement, that is to say, defending companies and municipalities against discrimination lawsuits and so forth. And they were much more likely to have very conservative credentials, such as membership in the Federalist Society, the Republican National Lawyers Association, Christian activist groups. And along with that change, the focus of the Civil Rights Division has also been shifting. They have been putting more resources into religious discrimination lawsuits, especially defending Christians against religious discrimination. They've been putting less emphasis on what used to be the bread and butter of the division, which would be large lawsuits alleging systematic discrimination against African Americans.
Is there any way of knowing how permanent the hiring changes in the Justice Department will be?
Well, this is interesting. Just a few weeks ago, the Justice Department announced internally that they were going back to the old way of doing hiring in the Civil Rights Division, at least, which is to say they were now going to have committees of career staffers once again screening applications and recommending whom to hire. However, when one talks to the numerous, in some cases, 30-year veterans of these divisions that have all sort of fled in the last few years, taken buyouts, quit, and otherwise been driven out, they are skeptical about whether this actually means that everything got rolled back, because the career ranks are different today than they were in 2001. Very you know, many of the long-standing traditional career civil rights lawyers have left, and they've been replaced already with very conservative lawyers. And so a career hiring committee made up of Federalist Society members is not going to produce, they say, a remarkably different result than what we've seen with the political appointees, the technically political appointees, the last few years.
Let me get back to Regent University and the Regent University Law School, founded by Pat Robertson. There is a very specifically Christian mission to the teaching. For instance, what's the mission at the law school?
Well, the law school, like the whole university, shares as its motto, Christian leadership to change the world. When Pat Robertson founded this school, which was originally the Christian Broadcasting Network school and shares a campus with his televangelist studios, he had the idea of wanting an institution where Christian activists could come and study to take up positions of responsibility and influence in the world, where they would be able to spread Christian values, biblical values as they understood them, and try to change society in those places where they believed that secular law deviated from God's law.
You spent time there for one of your stories. What do you find interesting about the university now and the connections that it has with the Bush administration?
Well, Regent University itself has bragged on their website that they, though they are a small and young school, have 150 alumni serving in the Bush administration. And that is a remarkably large number. It was, yes, I did go down and spend a day at Regent, and I talked to a lot of students and professors and the dean, who I guess you're going to have on your show. I found it was a fascinating day. There's a number of interesting things you can say about Regent, one of which is, though it has been much ridiculed in recent months, in part because of its very low ranking in the U.S. news polls and other things, it's actually getting much better. They've put a huge amount of money into recruiting higher qualified students in recent years, and they've overhauled their curriculum, and they've started to win national law student competitions, which normally are won by Ivy Leaguers. And they're really a school that's on the rise. And so whatever else you may think about them, I think it's an error to not to take them seriously and their graduates seriously. Now, that I mean that especially about the students who are there now, because the students who were there in the 90s, before all these changes were made, really struggled. And I think the wake-up call, Dean Brow told me, to make these changes was when the majority of their students couldn't pass the bar exam in 1999, which was the year that Monica Goodling graduated from Regent. I also find it interesting just to sit in on their classes. They open each class with a 10-minute devotional prayer or sermon, sometimes led by students, sometimes led by professors. And then they go in and they have what is essentially a regular law class, especially in those areas in which there's not really much to say religiously about what's happening, such as, you know, standards of evidence in criminal law and so forth. On the other hand, I also sat through a constitutional law class in which the subject was substantive due process, especially as it related to laws that used to ban interracial marriage and were struck down in the Loving v. Virginia case. And it was very interesting because they were, as in any law school class, they were trying to just sort of figure out the basis on which the judges had decided that that law was unconstitutional and so forth. But hanging over the entire debate was the higher discussion was the issue of gay marriage today. Obviously, anyone who goes to Regent, or almost everyone who goes to Regent, is against gay marriage because they think it's contrary to biblical values and it should not be, you know, legalized in America. And so they were, but on the other hand, no one there thinks that people of different races should not be able to get married. And so they were struggling with how do we accept the Loving v. Virginia precedent and say that case was rightly decided, because certainly we're all on the same side on that, without also extending that to gay people who might want to get married. And so there was, and it's not necessarily that the professor was presenting that, but even the students in the class discussion were coming up with, well, maybe this is how we distinguish the two. Maybe this is other approaches, how we say this case was okay, but it goes no further. And so I don't think that's a discussion you might have heard in a different law school, or maybe it would have gone the other direction if it was a more liberal student body. I just thought that was a very interesting approach to what it's like to be a Regent Law student.
Well, Charlie Savage, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Charlie Savage is the legal correspondent for the Boston Globe.